I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, our conversation today about home mortgages. Why are even high-salaried prospective buyers with great credit being turned down? But first, the U.S. Embassy said three Americans were badly hurt today in the latest rocket attacks on the heavily fortified Green Zone in Baghdad. One American civilian reportedly died from an attack earlier this week. In addition, intense clashes between Iraqi government forces and rival Shiite militias in the southern port city of Basra have killed as many as 55 people in the past 2 days. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has gone to the area himself. This spike in violence comes as Washington awaits congressional testimony from Commander General David Petraeus. Well, joining us on the line from Baghdad is Washington Post correspondent Sundarsan Raghavan. And Sundarsan, give us the snapshot of Basra right now. A few years back, it was peaceful. The British pulled out this past December. So who is fighting whom today?
Well, Basra is a city under siege. It's been so for the past couple of years. What we're seeing is various militia groups, Shiite militia groups, fighting for control there. The main players are the Mahdi army, with the militia of Shiite cleric Muqtada Sadr, and they're fighting the Badr Brigade, which is the armed wing of the Supreme Council, which is another powerful Shiite political group. You also have smaller militias involved, belonging to the Fadila Party, as well as certain sort of splinter factions that certainly the U.S. military says is backed by Iran, and also you have criminal gangs working there too. So there's a whole hodgepodge of players there, but the end result has been a city that's basically been gripped by fear for quite a bit of time.
Well, there is a shaky peace between Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army and the Maliki government. There's been a shaky ceasefire between Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army and Maliki's Iraqi government. Maliki's government is largely Shia, and here he now is in Basra confronting these splinter groups of the Mahdi army. How dangerous a mix is that?
Well, it's raising fears that Muqtada al-Sadr's ceasefire is going to collapse. And if it does collapse, it has major implications for American policy there, because this ceasefire is widely credited by U.S. commanders and Iraqi politicians for really tamping down the violence that, levels that we've seen in recent months. What the Muqtada al-Sadr's loyalists are saying is that they're basically accusing the Maliki government of trying to abuse the ceasefire, take advantage of it in order to make political gains. They see the government's tactics of raids and mass arrests of Sadr followers, not just in Basra, but in other southern cities like Kut and Diwaniyah and Karbala, as an effort by their Shiite rivals, namely Maliki's Dawa Party, to essentially gain power ahead of provincial elections, which should come as early as in October this year.
Considered one of the political gains of the Maliki government, the fact that the elections are going to happen, the Prime Minister Maliki has given the gunmen in Basra an ultimatum to surrender in 3 days, or else what?
Well, the strong language that's coming from Mr. Maliki is somewhat unique. What he's really trying to show is that the Iraqi government can stand up for itself, and this is crucial. I mean, the timing of this is very, very interesting, because this whole Basra offensive arrives basically 2 weeks before General David Petraeus and U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker will basically sit up before Congress and issue a progress report on Iraq. And one of the things that they're certainly going to be looking at is discussing is how much is Iraq able to stand up on its own, and what you're seeing in Basra is probably the biggest test of that to date. And so the strong language Mr. Maliki is using is basically in part to show that he and his government are capable of exerting control over unruly areas in Iraq, and that he is the right man to lead Iraq.
Well, meanwhile, we read that back in Baghdad, Muqtada al-Sadr, the cleric, his followers have basically shut the city down, ordering stores to close and stopping buses and taxis. Sundarsan, is there any way to predict whether this is just a temporary spate of violence, perhaps ahead of adjustments in U.S. troop levels, or is it the beginning of a sustained cycle?
that's sort of the million-dollar question that every Iraqi is asking today. But, you know, one thing you got to understand is that Muqtada Sadr also, you know, is interested in winning these provincial elections. So what we could be seeing is for Muqtada Sadr to let everyone know that he is unhappy with the way things are going now, and that the government and the U.S. military needs to stop attacking his followers in order to keep the peace in Iraq.
Sudarshan Raghavan, Baghdad correspondent for The Washington Post. Sudarshan, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
If you're in the market for a mortgage, your zip code might be as important as your credit rating. If you have less than a certain down payment, a lender will want a mortgage insurer to back your loan. And some insurers have cut off zip codes in Arizona, Flint, Michigan, and Metuchen, New Jersey. Others have cut off entire states, such as Florida or Nevada, because of the high number of foreclosures there. During the housing boom, loans were flowing, and buyers got into bidding wars that drove home prices up. But then adjustable mortgage rates shot up, homeowners began defaulting, mortgage companies failing, and here we are. So how difficult is it to get a mortgage these days, or to refinance, or take out a home equity loan? Well, joining us first here in the studio, Amy Tierce, a mortgage lender here in Needham, Massachusetts. So Amy, how hard is it to get a mortgage today?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, we're having great success in my organization granting mortgages, but every borrower we speak to, it's an exercise trying to figure out how we're going to get it done. The restrictions have become overwhelming, and the elimination of programs has been huge.
Let's talk about some of the challenges and then, you know, why banks are so leery. Walk us through. A bank or a lender looks at a buyer's credit rating. How is a credit rating formed?
Well, the credit rating compiles several different aspects on your credit report, how much debt you have, how you use your debt. A great example is that you'll increase your credit scores if you have five credit cards that are maxed out and you make perfect payments. If you reduce the balances to 50% or 30% of the line, that'll jump your credit scores significantly. So they look at timely payment, obviously, and then they look at how much debt you're actually carrying every month, and that will be very negative on your credit score if you have a lot of it.
So numbers are in the 600, 700s normally.
Yep.
Now, how has the way the credit score number been used changed in the last couple weeks?
They've tightened dramatically the required credit score for different lending programs, and then Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who buy all of these mortgages, have put loan level pricing on credit score related on mortgages. So when everybody would get quoted a similar rate with a credit score from 620 to 900, today there are adjustments that start at 620 where you will see your rate be a point or a point and a half higher up to 719. Anybody over 719 gets prime interest rate.
That gets us to the difference between prime and subprime.
Uh-huh.
But it also, I just want to stop there for a second, because that number shot way up. We're understanding that last summer, if your credit score was below 620, you were cut off. You were considered, you know, not a good credit rate. But now you're saying up at 719.
Below 620 in the old days was considered a subprime mortgage, and 620 and up was prime.
Well, actually, let me jump in there,
okay,
because that's very important, prime and subprime.
Mm-hmm.
Buyers with prime rates have a better time with the bank.
Yes.
Subprime doesn't.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. But now it takes a lot better credit to
yes.
be a prime buyer.
Absolutely, it does. And those, you know, a 620 credit score I never thought was a great credit score, but a 680 credit score I always thought was pretty good. And so you really have to change the way you look at and counsel your borrowers.
Okay. So now you have to have much better credit.
Mm-hmm.
You also have to have more money to put down. How much money, because the next step is a buyer, potential buyer, offers a down payment. How much money are you now required to put down to buy a house?
Well, pretty much most programs with 5% down have been eliminated in most markets in our state, in Massachusetts, and across the country. Essentially, the lenders look at whether they determine an area, a county, a zip code to be in a declining value area. And at that point, you cannot qualify for 100% financing or 95% financing. So in today's market, you really need a 10% down payment. There are a couple of pockets of specialized programs for low to moderate borrowers and FHA programs that are government-backed that do allow higher loan to values,
but still,
pretty much 10% is the way it has to go today.
And we were seeing 0%
absolutely.
A while ago. Okay, so you have to have more money to put down. But now we're reading in a recent Boston Globe article that people with top credit ratings, terrific jobs, great salaries, big down payments are being turned down for things like they're moving and the bank just doesn't trust they're going to get that new job. Or, you know, what are some of the other reasons that people are tightening?
I think that lenders are just becoming more and more conservative about the way they look at things. And I recently had a borrower with a big down payment and great credit, and the lender declined the loan.
Why?
Because they had a percentage of income to housing debt ratio, and they wouldn't allow it to go over it. So here was a borrower with perfect credit, with a lot of money in the bank after the closing, and yet that number, the percentage of his income going to his housing debt, was 2 points higher than they required in their guidelines, and they wouldn't make an exception.
Well, we understand that this is happening across the country. There are national stats on this. The Federal Reserve does these surveys. Apparently 55% of senior loan officers are tightening their standards to prime customers now, and that's up 15% from a few months ago. One of the fears, we understand, is that that house that you might be buying with all that money and all that, you know, the salary and the down payment and the great credit may be overvalued. So how much is the inspection fitting into all of this and the bank's view of what that house is worth?
Appraisals are tough. The lenders are looking for more, you know, deeper appraisals with more comparable properties. And when the sales market is slow and there aren't a lot of sales to use to compare to the property, the subject property, it does get pretty difficult.
Do you think, as some are speculating, that, you know, when we were in the boom and there was a lot of money, appraisers were almost being encouraged to just, you know, pass on it, just pass on it, just okay it. And now, perhaps even overcompensating, some lenders are leaning on appraisers to say, you know what, just you be real tough on whether that house is valued at the mortgage.
I think that there are a lot of layers of things going on. Absolutely, lenders would go, bring the value in. I need that house to appraise, and pressure appraisers who are dependent on the lenders for their income. Also, in the real boom years, these companies were dealing with so many loan applications, they weren't even looking at the paperwork in the file. Yeah. And now they are ripping every piece of paper apart. So they're really looking at appraisals today.
Well, then there are equity lines. These are second loans beside a mortgage taken out and backed by the home's value. A few months ago, analysts were advising people to secure an equity line in case you needed some extra money. Now we're reading a chilling story again in the Boston Globe about, in one case, a power couple with high salaries, low mortgage, great credit, and Countrywide, one of the nation's largest lenders, canceling their equity line.
Well, one of the things that happens with equity lines is they're in what's called second position. If a house went into foreclosure, the first mortgage gets paid off, and the equity line comes second. And so if they feel there's any risk in the market, in the economy, or with declining values, they're going to reduce or pull back on the equity lines because those are not going to get paid.
That's Amy Tierce of Fairway New England Mortgage here in Needham, Massachusetts. We're going to be back with more from Amy, talk more home equity lines and regulation. Should the government regulate the industry more? A lot of these mortgage companies created in the last 10 years were really just houses of cards, and they collapsed under the weight of foreclosure. So should there be more regulation, or how do you find a reputable company like Amy's is? More on Mortgages 2008, and later in the show, are you dreaming of presidential candidates? Well, a lot of people are. We'll find out what those dreams mean. And also, NPR's Scott Simon's coming up. Back in 1 minute, here and now. Back with more from Amy Tierce of Fairway New England Mortgage in Needham, Massachusetts. Amy, let's look at refinancing, someone looking for lower rates.
Well, the problem that we're really experiencing most is that appraisals aren't coming in. So if somebody put 20% down on a house a couple of years ago, today they don't have that equity, and the rates aren't as favorable as the loan-to-value on the mortgage goes up.
I'm going to take a stab at interpreting that. You mean that people are going in trying to refinance and finding that their house wasn't as valuable as it was when they first bought it.
Exactly. So therefore, they can't get the same kind of favorable rate and terms. And for a lot of people, we just have to cancel their loans after we order an appraisal.
And Amy, you're one of these middle people we hear about. You're not a bank. You're a lender. You get your clients a mortgage and then you sell it. Now, we hear from people like Congressman Barney Frank that these kinds of companies are in some cases part of the problem because after you give out a mortgage, you no longer have to worry about it being paid because you've sold it. And so if someone's unscrupulous, they could make as many loans as they want, even bad ones. And what do they care? Because the failure is someone else's problem. So do you think there should be more regulation, maybe even elimination of some of these companies?
Well, I have to say that I think that the structure of the company that I represent actually is a very healthy one for the consumer because we can offer a variety of mortgage and products and programs. We have a lot of expertise. And we can get very difficult transactions done for people or the easy ones at competitive prices. However, the industry has ended up regulating itself in that so many of the programs that got us into trouble have been eliminated. We don't learn. So if there's an opportunity for profit 5 years later and the market is booming, I think that the legislative efforts that have now been put into place will see that some of these programs never come back again, and I don't think they should.
Well, and that's, you know, good news for consumers, but some are saying they're hearing you say you make these, you know, these difficult mortgages work, and some people would say maybe they shouldn't have.
I make difficult mortgages work for people who should get mortgages. I'll tell you, in the 20 years I've been in the business, to the best of my knowledge, I haven't had a foreclosure. I've done a lot of training around ethical behavior in the mortgage business. I'm pretty committed to it.
How do you keep those people out, though? I mean, the point is that you are helping people who deserve to be helped,
yes,
but there are others pushing people,
yes,
into mortgages who can't pay one.
Well, thankfully, the economics of today's environment, I think, have gotten rid of a lot of those people. But also, the state of Massachusetts has just instituted loan officer licensing. People will have to have criminal background checks, be fingerprinted, pay $500 a year to remain licensed. Hopefully we'll make it tough enough to stay in the business that a lot of people will find new careers.
That's Amy Tears of Fairway New England Mortgage in Needham, Massachusetts. Amy, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thanks.
So as Amy said, lending practices are changing and the market has winnowed itself. New Century, Ameriquest, Option One, companies created in the last 10 years have all gone out of business. And being rejected for a loan today may show you're in over your head. Vikas Bajaj is a New York Times business correspondent. He joins us now. Vikas, how would you characterize how lending is changing?
You know, Robin, the way to think about this is that it's going back to the basics. It's going back to more sort of a traditional banking relationship where lenders make sure that the borrowers can pay the loan and they make sure that the property is appraised properly.
Well, but we know that there are these different layers of lending. It's not like it was when Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life, you know, was at the bank and it was your local bank that was lending. We now have other companies. We just heard from Amy. Her company is a mortgage company backed by investors who come up with the money for these mortgage loans. They turn around and then sell the mortgage to another company who takes responsibility for it. She's very reputable. But how do you know that you're at a reputable lender?
The way you know is you have to shop around. You have to make sure that the deal you're getting is not too good to be true. And the way you know that is by going to a bunch of different lenders. Maybe you go to a mortgage broker, you go to a bank, you go to your credit union, you go to another bank, you go to a mortgage company. You go to maybe four or five different people and sort of compare what's on offer. And if one of them appears to be too good to be true, take a closer, harder look at the numbers and see what's different.
If we're hearing that you have less than 20% for a loan, a lender will require that there be mortgage insurance. And some mortgage insurance companies are refusing to insure, you know, entire zip codes because of the amount of foreclosures. So what do you do if you are knocked out and you think unfairly?
You know, you just have to be much more conservative when you're buying in a place like that. You must have a big down payment. If you don't, wait. You know, there's nothing to say that you need to buy a house right now. Renting can be perfectly reasonable alternative for a short period of time.
After the dust has settled, what companies are still in the business, and what are they doing?
Yeah, all the traditional banks, all the big banks are still in the business. Bank of America, Citigroup, Chase, Wells Fargo, Washington Mutual. These guys are all doing loans. Credit unions are doing a lot of loans now. Community banks, small community banks that had lost a big portion of their business to mortgage companies are now sort of resurgent again. And you even have some of the larger mortgage companies like Countrywide are still in business, and Countrywide's being acquired by Bank of America. So there's plenty of options. It's just that you're going to have to approach this much more conservatively, and you're going to have to put down more money, and there's going to be fewer creative adjustable rate loans out there.
So when you're shopping around for a mortgage, you know, what should you look for?
Well, you should look for the interest rate, obviously, first and foremost. How much are you going to be paying? You should look at the term of the loan. Is it a 15-year, 30-year, 40-year loan? Is it fixed? Is it adjustable? You want to know if there's a prepayment penalty and how long that will last. Points and fees. How much are you paying in closing costs for this loan? And how much is going to the broker and how much is going to the lender? And are there any fees and paid outside of closing that can also influence the kind of loan you get?
Homeowners have tended to think of their homes as banks. Mm-hmm. How much of that has to be rethought?
There was a report out from the Federal Reserve earlier this month that showed that equity that Americans have in their homes, the aggregate equity, has fallen below 50% for the first time. If you think of the house as an ATM or a piggy bank, for a lot of people, the piggy bank has sort of essentially run dry.
Vikas Bajaj, business correspondent for The New York Times, thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
Well, staying on this theme, tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to take a recession road trip to a small town in Massachusetts where signs of the slumping economy aren't immediately evident. On Main Street, hair salons and restaurants are doing well, but people are apparently not replacing their washing machines. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, dreaming about the presidential candidates. Do you dream that John McCain is Billy Idol? Someone is. We'll find out what that means after the news, Here and Now. Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, referred to the interpretation of dreams as the royal road to the understanding of unconscious mental processes. So, how do we apply that to a dream about Hillary Clinton eating a frozen pineapple treat that she found in a bathroom stall, or to a recurring dream of being Michelle Obama? These are just some of the dreams submitted to a new website. It's called www.idreamofhillaryidreamofbarack.com. It was started by Sheila Hetty, a writer in Toronto, and it's branched out to include Republican presidential candidate John McCain. We thought we'd call Dr. Prudy Gorgashone, the president-elect of the American Psychoanalytic Association, to find out what these dreams might tell us, if anything, about our subconscious this election year. She joins us now. Doctor, first of all, we know dreams are not surely what they seem on face value. They represent something else, right?
Right. Dreams aren't at all what they are on face value. Basically, the way I think of a dream is that it is your unconscious mind doing something very creative. And in a funny way, most of us aren't as creative in our daily lives, waking lives, as we are in our dream life.
Right.
So your unconscious mind wants to tell your conscious mind a story about concerns or feelings or mysteries, desires, intrigues, that it can't tell you in any other way, that you can't become aware of in any other way.
Let's start with some of the dreams about the presidents. Let's start with Barack Obama. There were a remarkable number of people that seemed to experience, I don't know, almost a sense of being let down.
Mm-hmm.
What do you interpret?
Well, when I looked at the dreams about Obama on the site, there were two themes closely related. One was a great deal of extraordinary hope. He was seen as very special. He was seen as almost a savior in some ways.
Well, I'm thinking of some of the dreams where a sun shines across a glowing field while he speaks.
Right. Another one where he sees the horizon very clearly. There's one where there's some gold shining down on him.
Yeah.
I think that the theme of hope that we've all heard about in his campaign is really captured in those dreams, extraordinary level of hope. With hope goes the fear of disappointment. So I saw the disappointment dreams as really an anxiety dream. To the extent that a candidate stirs up great hope, he or she's going to stir up great fear of letdown. People love to hope, but they're also terribly afraid of it.
Are we really dreaming about the presidents when we dream about the presidents, or are they just standing in for something else?
No, we're really dreaming about ourselves for the most part. A dream, as I explained initially, is telling you something about your own thoughts and feelings. However, these are characters that are extraordinarily important to us. In this campaign, I guess, more than any that I can remember. And so they become the embodiment of fears and hopes and dreams that we have inside ourselves.
Or bad wardrobe choices, because I'm thinking, I'm thinking of the Hillary Clinton dreams. In many of these dreams, she's wearing, you know, outrageous clothing.
Yeah, I know. That was very funny. I think, well, here's my take on that. I think that Hillary Clinton embodies and evokes, I mean, both just by existing, and what she stirs up in people is all sorts of versions of the issues we have about women and femininity. And the wardrobe is a great way. I mean, in one dream, she's wearing a red satin ball gown and stilettos, I think.
Yes.
Well, to me, these are all sort of images of womanhood, and that the dreamers out here in the populace and the electorate are struggling with, or stirred up about, rather, what they want in a woman and what they see in her, what kinds of womanhood they see in her, what versions of being a woman.
We hear a sexy red bathing suit is another mm-hmm. outfit, a dress made of endangered penguins.
Well, yeah, that dress made of endangered penguins was one of my favorites. That was actually about a theme of cruelty in her that did show up in, I don't know, three or four or five dreams.
Well, what is the dream about Hillary that involves pineapples say to us? One, she's coming out of a bathroom stall eating a frozen pineapple treat. Another, there's simply a piece of pineapple on a plate near her.
Well, the way I listen to an image, a symbol in a dream as a psychoanalyst is, okay, a patient or a person says, I dreamt about a pineapple. What does that mean? I start kind of daydreaming about a pineapple, and what came to my mind is it's prickly on the outside, but it's very sweet on the inside. To me, that dream might be somebody trying to integrate the various aspects of Clinton that they perceive.
Well, we understand you had your own presidential dream. It was about Barack Obama coming to your house. What happened?
Well, I noticed he was tired, and I asked him if he'd had anything to eat. And he said yes. And then I thought to myself, oh, that's the wrong question. The way he is, he would say yes, because if he'd eaten ever, he would say he'd had something to eat. So then I said, well, did you have any lunch? And he said, no. And I said, well, can I get you something to eat? I really, really wanted to feed him. And he said, actually, I just want to sleep. I am so tired. That was my dream.
What do you think it meant?
Well, I thought about it. First of all, he was tired. I'd seen him the night before on the political shows. And that's what people do with dreams. They pick up images from the previous day. We call it day residue. And he had looked tired on that occasion. I also noticed from the dream the sense of specialness, that he was the type of person who, also that he was a little remote. And I hadn't picked up that aspect of my perception of him till I had the dream, although in a lot of the dreams we looked at on the site, there was a theme of slight remoteness in him, also a theme of friendliness. And then finally I thought of something he used to say. I'm in Illinois, and you know, I saw his Senate campaign, and he used to say in his speeches, I'm a skinny kid from Chicago. And when I thought of that, I thought of my own son, who is a skinny kid from Chicago and who is away in law school, and I wish I could feed him. So that's where the political public image came back home.
Huh.
And that's how a dream intertwines the individual story and the public story.
There were some dreams that were sexual in nature about Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and I don't know, maybe this comes close. There was one about John McCain where he was one and the same with Billy Idol.
So. Yeah, I didn't get that. Did you consider that a sexual one?
Well, some might, you know, followers of Billy Idol. But what does sexuality in a dream about a presidential candidate mean?
Well, I thought that was very striking, a little surprising to me, but it was all over the place. Lots and lots of romance and sexuality. My hunch is it has nothing to do with sexuality, really. There is a psychoanalytic theory that dates back to the 40s, coming from a British analyst named Bion, who said that groups function as a sort of group psyche. One of the fantasies they create is that there will be a pairing. Out of that sexual pairing will come something new and hopeful and redemptive. That was my take on it, that it's not sex per se, it's excitement, and it's also perhaps a symbol that conveys the hope for something new being created.
Well, in fact, one of the dreams came from a 24-year-old Texas man who dreamt of having relations with Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And he said for the first time in his life, he had feelings of sympathy and admiration for her. Uh-huh. It was some sort of a crossover event for him. And he woke up seeing how power in her life was acquired through a personal sacrifice of sexual desires. Very complicated.
That was a very complicated
dream.
One. Yeah, that was a very complicated one.
Yeah. And I'm sure at this point a lot of listeners are going, I don't want to hear more about your dreams about the presidential candidates. I've heard too much. Dr. Gorgashan, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
But just in case, if you are desperate to share your dream, send it to us at here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org. Okay, we're going to get back to harsh reality. In the days ahead, we'll take a look at why the electricity is still off in Anbar province in Iraq. You're listening to Here and Now. Now to a sizzling novel about politics in Chicago, in the state where two presidential candidates cut their teeth, one literally. Who would ever be interested in that? That's my best imitation of how NPR's Scott Simon might introduce his new novel. It's called Windy City. At its outset, the outsized mayor of Chicago is found dead in his office, face down in his pizza box, which turns out to be the murder weapon. The pizza had been poisoned. The mayor was a corruptible, back-slapping, cigar-chomping Paul. In other words, he was beloved. City officials make noise about investigating his death while cutting backroom deals to replace him. As his vice mayor, the quiet alderman from the 48th Ward, Sundaran Sunny Rupini, watches. In one flashback, the mayor, before he dies, asks Sunny what he wants out of his political life.
"Want isn't a weakness, Sunny," he announced. "We'd still be trailing our tails if one of our ancestors hadn't decided he was tired of getting sand up his ass and came out of the water to walk. Want is the wind that spins the world around," the mayor declared slowly and musically. "Nothing shameful about that. I am useful to my friends and strike fear in my enemies. I get my name on schools. I don't stop for red lights. The owner always sends over dessert. Everyone laughs at my jokes. People who wouldn't hire me with my night school degree now beg me to give jobs to their sons. People ponder the significance of me clearing my throat. People compete to make me smile like I was a 2-year-old. I bestow a wink or a nod and they tell the story till they die. It's a nice life. I don't want to live any other way."
And author Scott Simon joins us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Scott, welcome.
Thank you, Robin. Good to be with you.
So what would your first question to yourself be?
Why did you write this book? And I would only ask that because I couldn't think of anything else.
Well,
you know, when I became a novelist, Random House sent me to one of those courses to learn how to be interviewed. And the woman who was head of publicity at Random House said, "There are a lot of people here who say you shouldn't send Scott Simon through one of those courses. For goodness sakes, don't insult him." And she said, "I am doing it because you are who you are and what you do. Because I'm telling you, being interviewed is totally different from actually doing the interviewing yourself. And one of the things you have to learn as an author is, certainly I say this now having written a political comedy, you need to be a little bit like a political candidate, which is to lightly acknowledge and brush aside any of your questions so I can get to the main business, which is talking about my book."
Well, let's do that. This is your beloved Chicago you're writing about. You know it inside out. So tell us, who are these people? What were you trying to say about them?
I wanted to write a political comedy, and I'm very intent on telling people it's a comedy, not a satire, because satire implies exaggeration. And I just thought that there was a lot of comedy and enjoyment, and to be sure, I hope some pertinent and fair-minded observations about life in the big cities today that could be made with the Chicago City Council as a backdrop. And I chose city council members because they're not surrounded by a retinue of aides the way congressmen and senators are. Mm. And to be sure, when I began writing the novel, I think I had something a little bit more mocking and snide in mind. But when you begin to write something from the point of view of your characters and you spend that much time with them, you begin to see the world as they do. I hope it winds up being a book that really has a great deal of empathy for the people who turn their lives over to politics and find the bargain they make is just all-involving and consuming, and it takes a lot out of their lives.
You credit several aldermen with taking you into their real lives and your acknowledgments in the book. You know, what did you learn from them?
I think I had not known before I had a chance to talk to them how at once, how utterly self-absorbed and how selfless political life can be. Self-absorbed in the sense that whatever happens in the world, you know, if there's, God forbid, a plane crash in Mongolia, even a Chicago City alderman or a Boston City councilman has to say, "Hey, how does that affect me? Got any families here in my ward or district? How does this affect me? Maybe we got to do something about air safety. Maybe I should get out in front of that issue because a lot of publicity about this." On the other hand, it is utterly selfless in the sense that your time is not your own. If you spend Wednesday night at a community meeting in the Edgewater District listening to people talk about new bus routes, you have to spend Thursday night in the Lakeshore District listening to people talk about proposed zoning changes. Otherwise, the people in that district think that you think more of the one district you were there the night before. And they just will not hear of you saying, I'm sorry, I have to go to my daughter's school play. It's the most important thing they have going on in their civic life, and they kind of demand the attendance of their elected representative. So the way it just chews up real estate inside of somebody's life was a real illustration.
Okay, I tell you what, we're going to take a break, and we're going to have much more with Scott Simon in just 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more from Scott Simon. His latest novel is Windy City, a political comedy that begins with the death of Chicago's beloved mayor, poisoned by the pizza he was consuming. Members of the Chicago City Council then jockey for position to replace him. One of them is Alderman Sundaran Sunny Rupini, an Indian American who represents the 48th Ward. Scott Simon based Rupini on the real alderman he met in Chicago, his beloved hometown. And Scott, you just reunited with some of these real characters in Chicago, including one reunion at City Hall with a Chicago cop who informed another prominent character in your book.
Sergeant Tina Butler is the sergeant-at-arms at the City Council.
That's right.
And as I think I said in the acknowledgments, my imagination is simply too poor to make up another sergeant-at-arms. I just think of her so much as the sergeant-at-arms. So we went in through City Hall and we looked up Sarge. And Sarge, I don't mind telling you, she burst into tears. She'd gotten the galleys of the book, and she turned to the acknowledgments, and she said, frankly, she hadn't begun to read the book. And then Alderman Burke, chairman of the Finance Committee, called her up to his office and said, hey, Sarge, you know you're a character in this book. And she said, well, I know I'm in the acknowledgments. He said, no, you're a character. You're a character. I mean, you get to do real things. You're a character.
The sergeant-at-arms, she plays this just wonderful, knowing, strong, like a Cagney Lacey character that guards the politicians.
As she absolutely is. Sergeant Tina Butler absolutely is. And one of the things when I began to research Windy City just by absorbing the atmosphere of the city council, she said to me, I remember she took my hand and she said, Mr. Simon, my guys and gals here, a lot of people make fun of them. But let me tell you, they are good and decent human beings, and they do the best they can for the whole city of Chicago, and I love them all to death. And I was so impressed by her sense of conviction. It made me materially see the people in that chamber differently. Not that they're all heroic or perhaps even as admirable as Sergeant Butler finds them, but her attitude seems to be, look, they have been elected to do the city's business. I have been elected to protect them. Let's at least give them respect.
The book could also be titled How I Ate My Way Through the Windy City, because you go to restaurant after restaurant with your characters. Just tick off the different foods your characters eat.
Well, let me see. In the course of the book, dosas, which I learned how to make in an Indian restaurant myself, chilaquiles, which, of course, are Mexican. Let me see. Korean barbecue, thuringer, the German sausage, pot stickers.
What are you saying about Chicago with that? I mean, the way you chose to illustrate the city.
As one of my most clownish aldermen says, he refers to the city and he says, and all of the peoples of the world who call it home. And I'm sitting in Chicago right now, and all the peoples of the world, one way or another, are represented in this city. I think commonly these days, all great cities. And the food is there because often these neighborhood restaurants are neighborhood institutions, and that is where a lot of conversations take place and a lot of business gets transacted. My alderman, Sonny Rapini, who becomes the acting interim mayor on the death of the mayor, runs a restaurant, an Indian restaurant himself, which is not just a restaurant. It becomes the base of his political career. So it's obvious that he would notice the food. But I also think in big cities, food is often kind of the first thing that leaps the cultural boundary, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Thai families have relatively recently come to the United States, and to remind themselves of home and to have a kind of community meeting center, they open up Thai restaurants. I grew up in this great cosmopolitan city, never hearing about Thai food until about 20 years ago. And, of course, people begin to try it. Now Thai food has become almost as American as enchiladas and almost as American as pizza or egg rolls were before that. So I think it's a fair barometer of the way progress moves in a city and the way people, they open their stomachs and you hope the hearts and minds follow.
There are sexual shenanigans, some. I mean, one clue in the story
is sexual shenanigans,
well,
thank you, yes.
The mayor's
underwear. Perhaps the most lascivious single passage I have ever written. And I am not forgetting some of the nonsense that, as boys, we wrote in sixth grade,
on the bathroom
back of our
wall.
School assignments.
Right. Well, yeah. So let's just leave it at that. By the way, what was the message on the mayor's underwear when he was...
It says Big Daddy.
And as I'm reading some of these storylines, though, I'm thinking, oh, this is just unbelievable. And then, we think of just the last 2 weeks in news from New York and from New Jersey. And you realize, wow, you really have to stretch to make something unbelievable when you write about politics in a city like Chicago.
In this particular case, I have a number of so-called sex scandals that are breaking. And without giving away any plot points,
right.
I think the people involved tend to speak up decently for themselves. And I hope people just don't view it as a scandal, but as part of human lives that get revealed when the cloak is thrown back. And this is kind of another sub-theme of the book, the terrible cost to one's private life that being in politics takes out of a life. It's, stuff like this. This is in a decent world, nobody's business, gets thrown open for public delectation. Mm-hmm. And that's very difficult for people to withstand and live under that kind of scrutiny. And those who choose to do it have, at least on that elemental level, a world of respect from me.
That's Scott Simon. His new book is Windy City, A Novel of Politics. And while we have you, your thoughts on how either the city streets of Chicago affected Barack Obama or the suburban streets of Illinois shaped Hillary Clinton?
I think the way I notice it mostly in this campaign, you have to remember Barack Obama's campaign is run by David Axelrod, who is this Mayor Daley's longtime campaign manager. And I think the Obama campaign, being run by good Chicago ward politicians, understood the importance of the caucuses. They understood that if they really concentrated on the caucuses, they would be able to take Iowa and they would be able to put together a string of victories, even while sometimes losing a primary, that would first and last compile an impressive number of delegates, but secondly, I think, give the appearance of momentum towards being a popular choice. And I think if you take a look at the Clinton campaign, you can see some of the same things in the other direction. They made a calculation to go to the big state strategy, essentially ceding Illinois to Senator Obama. I think they both made choices that are consistent with the way they learned how to view politics in Chicago.
Well, and they, as I said, they both came out of that place that is probably not at all surprised, given
no,
how...
it's not. And until recently, Senator Clinton's campaign manager, Patty Solis Doyle, I mean, her brother is in the Chicago City Council as a Chicago alderman.
I'm speaking, too, to how people like you who came up in Chicago just love it so much.
I just don't say this to curry favor with a Boston audience who I hope will buy this book in vast numbers. But I think Boston has a lot of that same kind of character. And I think the people who come from places like Boston and Chicago remain Bostonians or Chicagoans stamped somewhere in their soul. It's a badge. It's an imprint that you carry. One of the things, by the way, I noticed about Senator Obama is when somebody at one of these public forums says to him, are you? But you've had so little experience. You're really tough enough to be president. He just kind of shakes his shoulders and goes, "Hey, I'm from the South Side of Chicago." Doesn't need to say anything else because that phrase communicates something to people. And I think people from cities like that with a certain amount of swagger, they're proud to be associated with the city because it tends to speak volumes.
Well, Scott, we air in Phoenix, Philadelphia, Detroit, so now you have to do that same.
And the same thing is true, Robin, in Phoenix and Detroit.
Yes.
Where else do you air, Robin?
Oregon and
Oregon,
California.
Yes. It's especially true in Oregon, which, as you know, Robin, because I've known you for a number of years, is probably odds on my favorite state in the country, isn't it?
Scott.
Especially the bookstores of Oregon. And the bookstores of Phoenix,
Scott,
you said?
Simon, NPR,
yes.
Scott Simon, also author of Windy City, A Novel of Politics. Scott, thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you.